or speak. A great calm came over me, and my vision narrowed. It seemed, very slowly, the closing of some great iris spiraling shut. Before me, I saw the nest on the ground, inches from my nose, its interwoven sticks slender, clever, the four greenish eggs round and fragile, perfect in its cup. Then a heel smashed down on the eggs, and the iris closed. The smell of burning roused me. I could have been unconscious for no more than moments. The clump of dry grass near my face was barely beginning to smoke. A hot coal glowed in a nest of char, shot with sparks. Threads of incandescence shot up the withered grass blades, and the clump burst into flame, just as hands seized me by the arm and shoulder, dragging me up. Still dazed, I flailed at my captor as he lifted me, but was hustled unceremoniously to one of the horses, heaved up, and flung across the saddle with a force that knocked the wind out of me. I had barely the presence of mind to grab at the stirrup leather as someone smacked the horse's rump and we set off at a bruising trot. Between dizziness and jostling, everything I saw was fractured, crazed like broken glass. But I caught one last glimpse of Marsali, now lying limp as a rag doll among a dozen tiny fires as the scattered coals began to catch and burn. I made some strangled noise, trying to call to her, but it was lost in the clatter of harness and men's voices speaking urgently near at hand.
"You crazed, Hodge. You don't want that woman. Put her back."
"I shan't."
The small man's voice sounded cross but controlled, somewhere near at hand.
"She'll show us to the whiskey."
"Whiskey'll do us no good if we're dead, Hodge. That's Jamie Fraser's wife, for Christ's sake."
"I know who she is. Get on with you."
"But he... you don't know the man, Hodge. I've seen him one time."
"Spare me your memories."
"Get on, I said."
This last was punctuated by a sudden vicious thunk and a startled sound of pain. A pistol butt, I thought. Square across the face, I added mentally, swallowing as I heard the wet, wheezing gasps of a man with a broken nose. A hand seized me by the hair and jerked my head round painfully. The thin man's face stared down at me, eyes narrowed in calculation. He seemed only to want to assure himself that I was indeed alive, for he said nothing, and dropped my head again, indifferent as though it were a pine cone he had picked up along the way. Someone was leading the horse I was on. There were several men on foot as well. I heard them calling to one another, half running to keep up as the horses lurched up a rise, crashing and grunting like pigs through the undergrowth. I couldn't breathe, save in shallow gasps, and was being jolted unmercifully with each step, but I had no attention to spare for physical discomfort. Was Marsali dead? She had looked it, surely, but I'd seen no blood, and I clung to that small fact for the slim and temporary comfort that it was. Even if she wasn't dead yet, she soon might be. Whether from injury, shock, a sudden miscarriage. Oh, God! Oh, God! Poor little Monsieur Leuf! My hands clenched helpless on the stirrup leathers, desperate. Who might find her? And when? It had lacked little more than an hour to supper time when I'd arrived at the malting shed. How late was it now? I caught glimpses of the ground juddering past below, but my hair had come loose and streamed across my face whenever I tried to raise my head. There was a growing chill to the air, though, and a still look to the light that told me the sun was near the horizon. Within a few minutes, the light would start to fade. And then what? How long before a search began? Fergus would notice Masali's absence when she didn't appear to cook supper. But would he go to look for her with the little girls in his care? No. He'd send Germain. That caused my heart to lurch and catch in my throat. For a 5-year-old boy to find his mother? I could still smell burning. I sniffed, once, twice, again, hoping that I was imagining it. But above the dust and sweat of horse, the tang of stirrup leather and the whiff of crushed plants, I could distinctly smell the reek of smoke. The clearing, the shed, or both were well and truly alight now. Someone would see the smoke and come. But in time? I shut my eyes tight, trying to stop thinking, seeking any distraction to keep from seeing in my mind's eye the scene that must be taking place behind me. There were still voices near. The man they called Hodge again. It must be his horse I rode. He was walking near its head on the far side of the animal. Someone else was expostulating with him, but to no more effect than the first man.
"Spread them out," he was saying tersely. "Divide the men in two groups. You'll have one. The rest go with me. Join again in 3 days' time at Brownsville."
Bloody hell. He expected pursuit and meant to frustrate it by splitting his group and confusing the trail. Frantically, I tried to think of something to drop. Surely I had something to leave as means of telling Jamie which way I'd been taken. But I wore nothing save shift, stays, and stockings. My shoes had been lost when they dragged me to the horse. The stockings seemed the only possibility, though the garters, with extreme perversity, were for once snugly tied and quite out of my reach at the moment. All around me I could hear the noise of men and horses moving, calling and shoving as the main body split. Hodge chirruped to the horse, and we began to move faster. My floating hair snagged on a twig as we brushed past a bush, held for a second, then broke free with a painful ping as the twig snapped, ricocheting off my cheekbone and narrowly missing my eye. I said something very rude, and someone, Hodge for a guess, dealt me a censorious smack across the bottom. I said something much, much ruder, but under my breath and through clenched teeth. My sole comfort was the thought that it would be no great trick to follow a band such as this, leaving, as they were, a wide trail of broken branches, hoof prints, and overturned stones. I'd seen Jamie track things small and sly, as well as large and lumbering, and had seen him check the bark of trees and the twigs of bushes as he went, for scratched bark and betraying tufts of hair. No one was walking on the side of the horse where my head hung down. Hastily I began to pluck hairs from my head. 3, 4, 5. Was that enough? I stretched out my hand and dragged it through a yorpen bush. The long, curly hairs drifted on the breeze of the horse's passing, but stayed safely tangled in the jagged foliage. I did the same thing 4 times more. Surely he would see at least one of the signs, and would know which trail to follow, if he didn't waste time following the other first. There was nothing I could do about that save pray, and I set in to do that in good earnest, beginning first with a plea for Massali and Monsieur Leuf, whose need was plainly much greater than mine. We continued upward for quite some time. It was full dark before we reached what seemed to be the summit of a ridge, and I was nearly unconscious, my head throbbing with blood, and my stays pushed so hard into my body that I felt each strip of whalebone like a brand against my skin. I had just enough energy left to push myself backward when the horse stopped. I hit the ground and crumpled at once into a heap, where I sat light-headed and gasping, rubbing my hands, which had swollen from hanging down for so long. The men were gathered in a small knot, occupied in low-voiced conversation, but too near for me to think of trying to creep away into the shrubbery. One man stood only a few feet away, keeping a steady eye on me. I looked back the way we had come, half fearing, half hoping to see the glow of fire far below. The fire would have drawn attention from someone. Someone would know by now what had happened, be even now spreading the alarm, organizing pursuit. And yet, Massali. Was she already dead, and the baby with her? I swallowed hard, straining my eyes at the dark, as much to prevent tears as in hopes of seeing anything. As it was, though, the trees grew thick around us, and I could see nothing at all, save variations on inky blackness. There was no light, The moon hadn't yet risen, and the stars were still faint. But my eyes had had more than enough time to adapt, and while I was no cat to see in the dark, I could distinguish enough to make a rough count. They were arguing, glancing at me now and then. Perhaps a dozen men. How many had there been originally? 20? 30? I flexed my fingers, trembling. My wrist was badly bruised, but that wasn't what was troubling me at present. It was clear to me, and therefore presumably to them as well, that they couldn't head directly for the whiskey cache, even were I able to find it at night. Whether Massali survived to talk or not, I felt my throat close at the thought. Jamie would likely realize that the whiskey was the intruder's goal and have it guarded. Had things not fallen out as they did, the men would ideally have forced me to lead them to the cache, taken the whiskey, and fled, hoping to escape before the theft was discovered. Leaving me and Massali alive to raise the alarm and describe them? I wondered. Perhaps? Perhaps not. In the panic following Masali's attack, though, the original plan had fallen apart. Now what? The knot of men was breaking up, though the argument continued. Footsteps approached.
"I tell you, it won't do," one man was saying heatedly.
From the thickened voice, I assumed it was the gentleman with the broken nose, undeterred by his injury.
"Kill her now. Leave her here. No one'll find her before the beasts have scattered her bones."
"Aye. And if no one finds her, they'll think she's still with us, won't they?"
"But if Fraser catches up to us and she's not, how shall he blame?"
They stopped, four or five of them surrounding me. I scrambled to my feet, my hand closing by reflex around the nearest thing approaching a weapon. An unfortunately small rock.
"How far are we from the whiskey?"
Hodge demanded. He had taken off his hat, and his eyes gleamed rat-like in the shadow. "I don't know," I said, keeping a firm grip on my nerves and the rock. My lip was still tender, puffed from the blow he had dealt me, and I had to form the words carefully.
"I don't know where we are."
This was true, though I could have made a reasonable guess. We had travelled for a few hours, mostly upward, and the trees nearby were fir and balsam. I could smell their resin, sharp and clean. We were on the upper slopes, and probably near a small pass that crossed the shoulder of the mountain.
"Kill her," urged one of the others. "She's no good to us, and if Fraser finds her with us..."
"Shut your face."
Hodge rounded on the speaker with such violence that the man, much larger, stepped back involuntarily. That threat disposed of, Hodge ignored him and seized me by the arm.
"Don't play coy with me, woman. You'll tell me what I want to know."
He didn't bother with the "or else." Something cold passed across the top of my breast, and the hot sting of the cut followed a second later as blood began to bloom from it.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said, more from surprise than pain.
I jerked my arm out of his grasp.
"I told you. I don't even know where we are, you idiot.
How do you expect me to tell you where anything else is?" He blinked, startled, and brought the knife up by reflex, wary, as though he thought I might attack him. Realizing that I wasn't about to, he scowled at me.
"I'll tell you what I do know," I said,
and was distinctly pleased to hear that my voice was sharp and steady. "The whiskey cache is about half a mile from the malting shed, roughly northwest. It's in a cave, well hidden.
I could take you there, if we began from the spring where you took me, but that's all I can tell you in the way of direction."
That was true, too. I could find it easily enough. But to give directions?
"Go through a gap in the brush a little way until you see the cluster of oak where Brianna shot a possum.
Bear left to a squarish rock with a bunch of adder's tongue growing over it." The fact that the need for my services as a guide was probably all that kept them from killing me on the spot was, of course, a secondary consideration. It was a very shallow cut. I wasn't bleeding badly at all. My face and hands were ice cold, though, and small flashing lights came and went at the edges of my vision. Nothing was keeping me upright, save a vague conviction that if it came to that, I preferred to die on my feet.
I tell you, Hodge, you don't want nothing to do with that one. Nothing.
A larger man had joined the small group round me. He leaned over Hodge's shoulder, looking at me, and nodded. They were all black in the shadow, but this man had a voice tinged with the lilt of Africa. An ex-slave, or perhaps a slave trader.
That woman. I hear about her. She is a conjure woman. I know them. They are like serpents, conjure wives. You don't touch that one, hear me? She will curse you.
I managed to give a rather nasty-sounding laugh in answer to this, and the man closest to me took half a step back. I was vaguely surprised. Where had that come from? But I was breathing better now, and the flashing lights were gone. The tall man stretched his neck, seeing the dark line of blood on my shift.
You draw her blood? Damn you, Hodge! You done it now!
There was a distinct note of alarm in his voice, and he drew back a little, making some sort of sign toward me with one hand. Without the slightest notion as to what moved me to do it, I dropped the rock, ran the fingers of my right hand across the cut, and in one swift motion reached out and drew them down the thin man's cheek. I repeated the nasty laugh.
"Curse, is it?" I said. "How's this? Touch me again and you'll die within 24 hours."
The streaks of blood showed dark on the white of his face. He was close enough that I could smell the sourness of his breath and see the fury gather on his face.
"What on earth do you think you're doing, Beecham?" I thought, utterly surprised at myself.
Hodge drew back his fist to strike me, but the large man caught him by the wrist with a cry of fear.
"Don't you do that! You will kill us all! I'll friggin' kill you right now, arsebite!"
Hodge was still holding the knife in his other hand. He stabbed awkwardly at the larger man, grunting with rage. The big man gasped at the impact, but wasn't badly stricken. He wrenched at the wrist he held, and Hodge gave a high squealing cry, like a rabbit seized by a fox. Then the others were all in it, pushing and shouting, grappling for weapons. I turned and ran, but got no more than a few steps before one of them grabbed me, flinging his arms round me and jerking me hard against himself.
"You're not going anywhere, lady," he said, panting in my ear.
I wasn't. He was no taller than I, but a good deal stronger. I lunged against his grip, but he had both arms wrapped tight around me and squeezed tighter. I stood stiff then, heart pounding with anger and fear, not wanting to give him an excuse to maul me. He was excited. I could feel his heart pounding too, and smell the reek of fresh sweat over the fetor of stale clothes and body. I couldn't see what was going on, but I didn't think they were fighting so much as merely shouting at each other now. My captor shifted his weight and cleared his throat.
"Where do you come from, ma'am?"
he asked, quite politely.
"What?"
I said, no end startled.
"Come from?"
England.
"Oxfordshire, originally. Then Boston."
"Oh, I'm from the north myself."
I repressed the automatic urge to reply, "Pleased to meet you," since I wasn't, and the conversation languished. The fight had stopped abruptly as it had started. With a lot of token snarling and growling, the rest of them backed down in the face of Hodge's bellowed assertions that he was in command here, and they'd bleeding well do as he said or take the consequences.
"He means it, too,"
muttered my captor, still pressing me firmly to his filthy bosom.
"You don't want a crossing, lady, believe me."
"Hm," I said, though I assumed the advice was well meant. I'd been hoping the conflict would be noisy and prolonged, thus increasing the chances of Jamie catching up to us.
"And where is this Hodge from, speaking of origins?" I asked. He still seemed remarkably familiar to me. I was sure I'd seen him somewhere, but where?
Hodgepyle? England, I reckon, said the young man, gripping me.
He sounded surprised.
Don't he sound like it?
Hodge. Hodgepyle.
That rang a bell, certainly, but...
There was a good deal of muttering and milling round, but in much too little time we were off again. This time, thank God, I was allowed to ride astride, though my hands were tied and bound to the saddle. We moved very slowly. There was a trail of sorts, but even with the faint light shed by a rising moon, the going was difficult. Hodgepyle no longer led the horse I rode. The young man who had recaptured me held the bridle, tugging and coaxing the increasingly reluctant horse through the thickets of brush. I could glimpse him now and then, slender, with thick wild hair that hung past his shoulders and rendered him lion-maned in silhouette. The threat of immediate death had receded a little, but my stomach was still knotted and the muscles of my back stiff with apprehension. Hodgepyle had his way for the moment, but there'd be no real agreement among the men. One of those in favour of killing me and leaving my corpse for the skunks and weasels might easily decide to put a quick end to the controversy with a lunge out of the dark. I could hear Hodgepyle's voice, sharp and hectoring, somewhere up ahead. He seemed to be passing up and down the column, bullying, nagging, nipping like a sheepdog, trying to keep his flock on the move. They were moving, though it was clear even to me that the horses were tired. The one I rode was shambling, jerking her head with irritation. God knew where the marauders had come from, or how long they had travelled before reaching the whiskey clearing. The men were slowing, too, a gradual fog of fatigue settling on them as the adrenaline of flight and conflict receded. I could feel lassitude stealing upon me, too, and fought against it, struggling to stay alert. It was still early autumn, but I was wearing only my shift and stays, and we were high enough that the air chilled rapidly after dark. I shivered constantly, and the cut on my chest burned as the tiny muscles flexed beneath the skin. It wasn't at all serious, but what if it became infected? I could only hope that I would live long enough for that to be a problem. Hard as I tried, I could not keep from thinking of Marsali, nor keep my mind from making medical speculations, envisioning everything from concussion with intracranial swelling to burns with smoke inhalation. I could do something, perhaps even an emergency C-section, if I were there. No one else could. I clenched my hands hard on the edge of the saddle, straining against the rope that bound them. I needed to be there. But I was not, and might never be. The quarrelling and muttering had all but ceased as the darkness of the forest closed in upon us, but a lingering sense of unease lay heavy on the group. In part, I thought it was apprehension and fear of pursuit, but in much greater part, a sense of internal discord. The fight hadn't been settled, merely postponed to a more convenient season. A sense of simmering conflict was sharp in the air. A conflict focused squarely on me. Unable to see clearly during the argument, I couldn't be sure which men held which opinions, but the division was clear. One party, headed by Hodgepyle, was in favour of keeping me alive, at least long enough to lead them to the whiskey. A second group was for cutting their losses and my throat. And a minority opinion, voiced by the gentleman with the African speech, was for turning me loose. The sooner the better. Obviously, it would behoove me to cultivate this gentleman and try to turn his beliefs to my advantage. How? I'd made a start by cursing Hodgepyle, and I was still quite startled that I'd done that. I didn't think it would be advisable to start cursing them wholesale, though. Ruin the effect. I shifted in the saddle, which was beginning to chafe me badly. This wasn't the first time I'd had men recoil from me in fear of what they thought I was. Superstitious fear could be an effective weapon,
but it was a very dangerous one to use. If I truly frightened them, they'd kill me without a moment's hesitation. We had crossed into the pass. There were few trees among the boulders here, and as we emerged onto the far side of the mountain, the sky opened out before me, vast and glowing, fiery with a multitude of stars. I must have let out a gasp at the sight, for the young man leading my horse paused, lifting his own head skyward.
"Oh," he said softly.
He stared for a moment, then was pulled back to earth by the passage of another horse that brushed past us, its rider turning to peer closely at me as it did so.
"Did you have stars like this, where you came from?" my escort asked.
"No," I said, still slightly under the spell of the silent grandeur overhead. "Not so bright."
"No, they weren't," he said, shaking his head, and pulled at the rein. That seemed an odd remark, but I could make nothing of it. I might have engaged him in further conversation. God knew I needed all the allies I could get. But there was a shout from up ahead. Evidently, we were making camp.
I was untied and pulled off the horse. Hodgepile pushed his way through the scrum and grasped me by the shoulder.
"You try to run, woman, and you'll wish you hadn't."
He squeezed viciously, fingers digging into my flesh.
"I need you alive. I don't need you whole."
Still gripping my shoulder, he lifted his knife and pressed the flat of the blade against my lips, jammed the tip of it up my nose, then leaned forward close enough that I felt the moist warmth of his very repugnant breath on my face.
"The one thing I won't cut off is your tongue," he whispered.
The knife blade drew slowly out of my nose, down my chin, along the line of my neck, and circled round the curve of my breast.
"You take my meaning, do you?"
He waited until I managed a nod, then released me and disappeared into the darkness. If he meant to unnerve me, he'd managed nicely. I was sweating despite the chill, and still shaking when a tall shadow loomed up beside me, took one of my hands, and pressed something into it.
"My name is Debbie," he murmured. "You remember that? Debbie. Remember, I was good to you. Tell your spirits they don't hurt Debbie. He was good to you."
I nodded once more, astonished, and was left again, this time with a lump of bread in my hand. I ate it hastily, observing that while very stale, it had originally been good dark rye bread, of the sort the German woman of Salem made. Had the men attacked some house near there, or merely brought the bread? A horse's saddle had been flung down on the ground near me. A canteen hung from the pommel, and I sank down on my knees to drink from it. The bread and the water, tasting of canvas and wood, tasted better than anything I'd eaten in a long while. I'd noticed before that standing very close to death improves the appetite remarkably. Still, I did hope for something more elaborate as a last meal. Hodgepile returned a few minutes later, with rope. He didn't bother with further threats, evidently feeling he'd made his point. He merely tied me hand and foot and pushed me down on the ground. No one spoke to me, but someone, with a kindly impulse, threw a blanket over me. The camp settled quickly. No fire was lit, and so no supper was cooked. The men presumably refreshed themselves in the same makeshift way I had, then scattered into the wood to seek their rest, leaving the horses tethered a little way off. I waited until the comings and goings died down, then took the blankets in my teeth and wriggled carefully away from the spot where I'd been placed, making my way, inchworm fashion, to another tree, a dozen yards away. I had no thought of escape in doing this, but if one of the bandits, in favour of disposing of me, should think to take advantage of the darkness in order to achieve their aims, I didn't mean to be lying there like a staked goat. With luck, if anyone came skulking round the spot where I'd been, I would have enough warning to scream for help. I knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that Jamie would come. My job was to survive until he did. Panting, sweating, covered with crumpled leaves, and with my stockings in rags, I curled up under a big hornbeam and burrowed back under the blanket. Thus concealed, I had a try at undoing the knots in the rope around my wrists with my teeth. Hodgepile had tied them, though, and had done so with military thoroughness. Short of gnawing gopher-like through the ropes themselves, I was going nowhere. Military. It was that thought that recalled suddenly to me who he was and where I had seen him before. Arvin Hodgepile. He'd been the clerk at the Crown's warehouse in Cross Creek. I had met him briefly, 3 years before, when Jamie and I brought the body of a murdered girl to the sergeant of the garrison there. Sergeant Murchison was dead, and I'd thought Hodgepile was as well, killed in the conflagration that had destroyed the warehouse and its contents. So, a deserter, then. Either he had had time to escape the warehouse before it went up in flames, or had simply not been there at the time. In either case, he'd been clever enough to realise that he could take this opportunity to disappear from His Majesty's army, leaving his death to be assumed. What he had been doing since then was clear, too. Wandering the countryside, stealing, robbing, and killing, and collecting a number of like-minded companions along the way. Not that they appeared to be of one mind just at present. While Hodgepile might be the self-proclaimed leader of this gang at the moment, it was plain to see that he hadn't held the position for long. He wasn't accustomed to command, didn't know how to manage men, save by threat. I'd seen many military commanders in my time, good and bad, and recognised the difference. I could hear Hodgepile even now, voice raised in distant argument with someone. I'd seen his sort before, vicious men who could temporarily cow those near them by outbursts of unpredictable violence. They seldom lasted long, and I doubted that Hodgepile was going to last much longer. He wasn't going to last any longer than it took for Jamie to find us. That thought calmed me like a slug of good whiskey. Jamie would surely be looking for me by now. I curled tighter under my blanket, shivering a little. Jamie would need light to track at night. Torches. That would make him and his party visible and vulnerable if they came within sight of the camp. The camp itself wouldn't be visible. There was no firelit, and the horses and men were scattered through the wood. I knew sentries had been posted. I could hear them moving in the wood now and then, talking low-voiced. But Jamie was no fool, I told myself, trying to drive away visions of ambush and massacre. He would know from the freshness of the horse's dung if he were drawing close, and certainly wouldn't be marching right up to the camp, torches blazing. If he had tracked the party this far, he would... The sound of quiet footsteps froze me. They were coming from the direction of my original resting place, and I cowered under my blanket like a field mouse with a weasel in sight. The steps shuffled slowly, to and fro, as though someone were poking his way through the dried leaves and pine needles looking for me. I held my breath, though surely no one could hear that, with the night wind sighing through the branches overhead. I strained my eyes at the darkness, but could make out nothing more than a faint blur moving among the tree trunks a dozen yards away. A sudden thought struck me. Could it be Jamie? If he had come close enough to locate the camp, he would very likely steal in on foot looking for me. I drew breath at the thought, straining against my bonds. I wanted urgently to call out, but didn't dare. If it should be Jamie, calling to him would expose his presence to the bandits. If I could hear the sentries, they could certainly hear me. But if it were not Jamie, at one of the bandits seeking to kill me quietly. I let my breath out very slowly, every muscle in my body clenched and trembling. It was cool enough, but I was bathed in sweat. I could smell my own body, the reek of fear mingling with the colder smells of earth and vegetation. The blur had vanished, the footsteps gone, and my heart was pounding like a kettle drum. The tears I had held back for hours seeped out, hot on my face, and I wept, shaking silently. The night was immense around me, the darkness filled with threat. Overhead, the stars hung bright and watchful in the sky, and at some point, I slept. Chapter 28 Curses. I woke just before dawn, in a muck sweat and with a throbbing headache. The men were already moving, grumbling about the lack of coffee or breakfast. Hodgepile stopped beside me, looking down with narrowed eyes. He glanced toward the tree beneath which he had left me the night before, and the deep furrow of disturbed leaf mould I had created in worm-crawling toward my present spot. He had very little in the way of lips, but his lower jaw compressed in displeasure. He pulled the knife from his belt, and I felt the blood drain from my face. However, he merely knelt and cut my bonds, rather than slicing off a finger by way of expressing his emotions.
"We leave in 5 minutes," he said, and stalked off.
I was quivering and faintly nauseated with fear, and so stiff that I could barely stand. I managed to get to my feet, though, and staggered the short distance to a small stream. The air was damp, and I was now chilly in my sweat-soaked shift, but cold water, splashed on my hands and face, seemed to help a little, soothing the throb behind my right eye. I had just time to make a hasty toilet, removing the rags of my stockings and running wet fingers through my hair, before Hodgepile reappeared to march me off again. This time I was put on a horse, but not tied, thank God. I wasn't allowed to hold the reins, though. My mount was on a leading rein, held by one of the bandits. It was my first chance to get a good look at my captors as they came out of the wood and shook themselves into rough order, coughing, spitting, and urinating on trees without reference to my presence. Beyond Hodgepile, I counted 12 more men, a baker's dozen of villains. It was easy to pick out the man called Tebby. His height aside, he was a mulatto. There was another man of mixed blood. Black and Indian, I thought, but he was short and squat. Tebby didn't glance in my direction, but went about his business with head lowered, scowling. That was a disappointment. I didn't know what had passed among the men during the night, but evidently Tebby's insistence that I be released was no longer so insistent. A rust-spotted kerchief bound his wrist. That might have something to do with it. The young man who had guided my horse the night before was also easy to pick out, by way of his long, bushy hair, but he didn't come near and avoided looking at me too. Rather to my surprise, he was an Indian. Not Cherokee. Perhaps a Tuscarora? I hadn't expected that from his speech, nor his curly hair. Clearly he was mixed blood, too. The rest of the gang were more or less white, but a motley crew nonetheless. Three of them were no more than half-bearded boys in their mid-teens, scruffy and gangling. They did look at me, goggling, drop-jawed and nudging one another. I stared at one of them until he met my eye. He went bright scarlet beneath his sparse whiskers and looked away. Fortunately, the shift I was wearing was one with sleeves. The thing covered me decently enough from drawstring neck to the hem at mid-calf, but there was no denying that I felt uncomfortably exposed. The shift was damp and clung limply to the curve of my breasts, a sensation I was uncomfortably aware of. I wished I had kept hold of the blanket. The men swirled slowly round me, loading the horses, and I had the distinct and unpleasant sense of being the centre of the mass, in much the same way a bull's-eye lies at the centre of a target. I could only hope that I looked aged and crone-like enough for my state of untidiness to be repellent rather than interesting. My hair was loose, wild, and tangled as witch's moss around my shoulders, and I certainly felt as though I'd been crumpled up like an old paper bag. I held myself bolt upright in the saddle, giving an unfriendly glare to anyone who so much as glanced in my direction. One man blinked blearily at my bare leg with a faint look of speculation, only to recoil noticeably when he met my eye. That gave me a momentary feeling of grim satisfaction, superseded almost immediately by shock. The horses had begun to move, and as mine obediently followed the man in front of me, two more men came into view, standing under a big oak. I knew them both. Harley Bobble was tying the strings on a pack saddle, scowling as he said something to another, larger man. Harley Bobble was an erstwhile thief-taker, now evidently turned thief. A thoroughly nasty little man, he was unlikely to be well disposed toward me, owing to an occurrence at a gathering some time before. I wasn't at all pleased to see him here, though I was by no means surprised to find him in such company. But it was the sight of his companion that caused my empty stomach to contract, and my skin to twitch like a horse with flies. Mr. Lionel Brown of Brownsville. He looked up, caught sight of me, and turned hastily away again, shoulders hunching. He must have realized that I had seen him, though, for he turned back to face me, thin features set in a sort of weary defiance. His nose was swollen and discoloured, a dark red bulb visible even in the greyish light. He stared at me for a moment, then nodded as though making some reluctant acknowledgement, and turned away again. I risked a glance back over my shoulder as we entered the trees, but couldn't see him any more. What was he doing here? I hadn't recognised his voice at the time, but clearly it had been he who had argued with Hodgepyle about the wisdom of taking me. Little wonder. He wasn't the only one disturbed by our mutual recognition. Lionel Brown and his brother Richard were traders, the founders and patriarchs of Brownsville, a tiny settlement in the hills some 40 miles from the ridge. It was one thing for freebooters like Bobble or Hodgepyle to roam the countryside, robbing and burning. Quite another for the Browns of Brownsville to be providing a base for their depredations. The very last thing in the world Mr. Lionel Brown could wish would be for me to reach Jamie with word of what he'd been up to. And I rather thought he would take steps to prevent me doing so. The sun was coming up, beginning to warm the air, but I felt suddenly cold, as though I'd been dropped in a well. Rays of light shone through the branches, gilding the remnants of the night mist that veiled the trees, and silvering the dripping edges of their leaves. The trees were alive with birdsong, and a towhee hopped and scratched in a patch of sun, oblivious of the passing men and horses. It was too early yet for flies and mosquitoes, and the soft morning breeze caressed my face. Definitely one of those prospects where only man was vile. The morning passed quietly enough, but I was aware of the constant state of tension among the men, though no more tense than I was. "Jamie Fraser, where are you?" I thought, concentrating fiercely on the forest around us. Every distant rustle or snap of twig might presage rescue, and my nerves began to be distinctly frayed in anticipation. Where? When? How? I had neither reins nor weapons. When an attack was made on the group, my best, well, the only possible strategy, was to fling myself off the horse and run. As we rode, I constantly evaluated each patch of witch hazel and stand of spruce, spotting footholds, plotting a zigzag path through saplings and boulders. It wasn't only an attack by Jamie and his men that I was preparing for. I couldn't see Lionel Brown, but I knew he was somewhere nearby. A spot between my shoulder blades clenched in a knot, anticipating a knife. I kept an eye out for potential weapons, rocks of a useful size, branches that might be seized from the ground. If and when I ran, I meant to let no one stop me. But we pushed on, moving as quickly as the horse's footing allowed, men glancing back constantly over their shoulders, hands on their guns. As for me, I was obliged to relinquish my imaginary grasp on each possible weapon in turn as it slid past, out of my sight. To my intense disappointment, we reached the gorge near midday, without incident. I had visited the gorge once with Jamie. The cataract fell 60 feet down a granite cliff face, sparkling with rainbows and roaring with a voice like the Archangel Michael. Fronds of red chokeberry and wild indigo fringed the falls, and yellow poplars overhung the river below the cataract's pool, so thick that no more than a fugitive gleam from the water's surface showed between the banks of lush vegetation. Hodgepile, of course, had not been drawn by the scenic beauty of the spot.
"Get off,"
a gruff voice spoke near my elbow, and I looked down to see Tebby.
"We will swim the horses across. You come with me."
"I'll take her."
My heart sprang up into my throat at the sound of a thickly nasal voice. It was Lionel Brown, pushing his way past an overhanging rope of creeper, dark eyes intent on me.
"Not you."
Tebby rounded on Brown, fist closed. "Not you," I repeated firmly. "I'm going with him." I slid off the horse and promptly took shelter behind the big mulatto's menacing frame, peering out at Brown from beneath the bigger man's arm. I wasn't under the slightest illusion about Brown's intent. He wouldn't risk assassinating me under Hodgepile's eye, but he could, and would, drown me easily, and claim it was an accident. The river was shallow here, but still fast. I could hear it whooshing past the rocks near the shore. Brown's eyes darted right, then left, thinking whether to try it on, but Tebby hunched his massive shoulders, and Brown gave it up as a bad job. He snorted, spat to one side, and stamped away, snapping branches. I might never have a better chance. Not waiting for the sounds of Brown's huffy exit to subside, I slipped a hand over the big man's elbow and squeezed his arm. "Thank you," I said, low-voiced, "for what you did last night. Are you badly hurt?" He glanced down at me, apprehension clear in his face. My touching him plainly disconcerted him. I could feel the tension in his arm as he tried to decide whether to pull away from me or not. "No," he said at last. "I am all right." He hesitated a moment, but then smiled, uncertainly. It was obvious what Hodgepile intended. The horses were being led, one at a time, down a narrow deer trail that edged the escarpment. We were more than a mile from the cataract, but the air was still loud with its noise. The sides of the gorge plunged steeply down to the water more than 50 feet below, and the opposite bank was equally steep and overgrown. A thick fringe of bushes hid the edge of the bank, but I could see that the river spread out here, becoming slower as it shallowed. With no dangerous currents, the horses could be taken downstream to come out at some random point on the opposite shore. Anyone who had succeeded in tracking us to the gorge would lose the trail here and have no difficulty in picking it up on the opposite side. With an effort, I stopped myself looking back over my shoulder for signs of imminent pursuit. My heart was beating fast. If Jamie was nearby, he would wait and attack the group when they entered the water, when they were most vulnerable. Even if he weren't yet here, it would be a confusing business crossing the river. If there was ever a time to attempt an escape.
You shouldn't go with them, I said conversationally to Tebby. You'll die too.
The arm under my hand jerked convulsively. He glanced down at me, wide-eyed. The sclera of his eyes were yellow with jaundice, and the irises broken, giving him an odd, smudgy stare.
I told him the truth, you know.
I lifted my chin towards Hodgepile, visible in the distance.
He'll die. So will all those with him.
There's no need for you to die, though.
He muttered something under his breath and pressed a fist against his chest. He had something on a string there, hanging beneath his shirt.
I didn't know whether it might be a cross or some more pagan amulet, but he seemed to be responding well to suggestions so far.
So close to the river, the air was thick with moisture, live with the smell of green things and water.
"The water is my friend," I said, trying for an air of mystery suitable to a conjure woman. I wasn't a good liar, but I was lying for my life. "When we go into the river, let go your hold. A water horse will rise up to carry me away."
His eyes couldn't get any wider. Evidently he'd heard of kelpies, or something like them.
Even this far from the cataract, the roar of the water had voices in it, if one chose to listen. "I am not going away with a water horse," he said with conviction. "I know about them. They take you down, drown you, and eat you."
"It won't eat me," I assured him. "You needn't go near it. Just stand clear once we're in the water. Keep well away."
And if he did, I'd be under the water swimming for my life before he could say Jack Robinson. I would be willing to bet that most of Hodgepile's bandits couldn't swim. Few people in the mountains could. I flexed my leg muscles, readying myself. Aches and stiffness dissolved in a flood of adrenaline.
Half the men were over the edge with the horses already. I could delay Tebby, I thought, until the rest was safely in the water. Even if he wouldn't deliberately connive at my escape, if I slipped his grasp, I thought he wouldn't try to catch me.
He pulled half-heartedly at my arm and I stopped abruptly. "Ouch! Wait! I've stepped on a burr."
I lifted one foot, peering at the sole. Given the dirt and resin stains adhering to it, no one could possibly have told whether I'd picked up cockle burrs, bramble fawns, or even a horseshoe nail.
"We need to go, woman."
I didn't know whether it was my proximity, the roar of the water, or the thought of water horses that was disturbing Tebby, but he was sweating with nerves. His odour had changed from simple musk to something sharp and pungent.
"Just a moment," I said, pretending to pick at my foot. "Nearly got it." "Leave it. I will carry you."
Tebby was breathing heavily, looking back and forth from me to the edge of the gorge where the deer trail disappeared into the growth, as though fearing the reappearance of Hodgepile.
It wasn't Hodgepile who popped out of the bushes, though. It was Lionel Brown, his face set with purpose. Two younger men behind him looking equally determined.
"I'll take her," he said, without preamble, grabbing my arm. "No."
By reflex, Tebby clutched my other arm and pulled. An undignified tug of war ensued, with Tebby and Mr. Brown each jerking one of my arms. Before I could be split like a wishbone, Tebby fortunately changed tactics. Releasing my arm, he seized me instead about the body and clutched me to himself, kicking out with one foot at Mr. Brown. The result of this manoeuvre was to cause Tebby and myself to fall backward into an untidy pile of arms and legs, while Brown also lost his balance, though I didn't realise at first that he had. All I was aware of was a loud yell and stumbling noises, followed by a crash and the rattle of dislodged stones bounding down a rocky slope. Disengaging myself from Tebby, I crawled out to discover the rest of the men grouped round an ominously flattened spot in the bushes fringing the gorge. One or two were hurriedly fetching ropes and yelling contradictory orders, from which I deduced that Mr. Brown had indeed fallen into the gorge, but was not yet certifiably dead. I rapidly reversed directions, meaning to dive headfirst into the vegetation, but came up instead against a pair of cracked boots belonging to Hodgepile. He seized me by the hair and yanked, causing me to shriek and lash out at him in reflex. I caught him across the midriff. He oofed and went open-mouthed, gasping for air, but didn't let go his iron grip on my hair. Making furious faces in my direction, he let go then, and boosted me toward the edge of the gorge with a knee. One of the younger men was clinging to the bushes, feeling gingerly for footholds on the slope below, one rope tied round his waist, and another slung in a coil over his shoulder. "Friggin' Mort!" Hodgepile yelled, digging his fingers into my arm as he leaned through the broken bushes. "What do you mean by this, you bitch?" He capered on the edge of the gorge like Rumpelstiltskin, shaking his fist and hurling abuse impartially at his damaged business partner and at me, while the rescue operations commenced. Tevi had withdrawn to a safe distance, where he stood looking offended. At length, Brown was hauled up, groaning loudly, and laid out on the grass. Those men, not already in the river, gathered round, looking hot and flustered.
"You mean to mend him, Conjure Woman?"
Tevi asked, glancing sceptically at me. I didn't know whether he meant to cast doubt upon my abilities, or only on the wisdom of my helping Brown. But I nodded, a little uncertainly, and came forward.
"I suppose so."
An oath was an oath, though I rather wondered if Hippocrates ever ran into this sort of situation himself. Possibly he did. The ancient Greeks were a violent lot, too. The men gave way to me easily enough. Once having got Brown out of the gorge, it was obvious that they had no notion what to do about him. I did a hasty triage. Aside from multiple cuts, contusions, and a thick coating of dust and mud, Mr. Lionel Brown had fractured his left leg in at least two places, broken his left wrist, and probably crushed a couple of ribs. Only one of the leg fractures was compound, but it was nasty, the jagged end of the broken thigh bone poking through skin and breeches, surrounded by a steadily widening patch of red. He had unfortunately not severed his femoral artery, since if he had, he would have been dead already. Still, Mr. Brown had probably ceased to be a personal threat to me for the moment, which was all to the good. Lacking any equipment or medication, bar several filthy neckcloths, a pine branch, and some whiskey from a canteen, my ministrations were necessarily limited. I managed, with no little difficulty and quite a lot of whiskey, to get the femur roughly straightened and splinted without having Brown die of shock, which I thought no small accomplishment under the circumstances. It was a difficult job, though, and I was muttering to myself under my breath, something I hadn't realized I was doing until I glanced up to find Tevi crouched on his heels on the other side of Brown's body, regarding me with interest.
"Oh, you curse him," he said approvingly. "Yes, that is a good idea."
Mr. Brown's eyes sprang open and bugged out. He was half off his head with pain and thoroughly drunk by now, but not quite so drunk as to overlook this.
"Make her stop," he said hoarsely. "Here, Hodgepile, make her stop. Make her take it back." "Here, what's this? What did you say, woman?"
Hodgepile had simmered down a bit, but his animus was instantly rekindled by this. He reached down and grabbed my wrist just as I was feeling my way over Brown's injured torso. It was the wrist he had twisted so viciously the day before, and a stab of pain shot up my forearm. "If you must know, I expect I said, 'Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ,'" I snapped. "Get go of me!"
"That's what she said when she cursed you. Get her away from me. Don't let her touch me."
Panicked, Brown made to squirm away from me. A very bad idea for a man with freshly broken bones. He went dead white under the smears of mud, and his eyes rolled back in his head.
"Look at that," "'He's dead,'
one of the onlookers exclaimed.
"'She's done it. She's witched him.'
This caused no little uproar between the vocal approbation of Tebby and his supporters, my own protests, and outcries of concern from Mr. Brown's friends and relations, one of whom squatted down by the body, putting an ear to the chest.
"'He's alive!' this man exclaimed. "'Uncle Lionel, you all right?'
Lionel Brown groaned loudly and opened his eyes, causing further commotion. The young man who had called him uncle drew a large knife from his belt and pointed it at me. His eyes were open so wide that the whites showed all around.
"'You get back,' he said. "'Don't you touch him!'
I raised my hands, palms out, in gesture of abnegation.
"'Fine,' I snapped. "'I won't.'
There was, in fact, little more I could do for Brown. He should be kept warm, dry, and well hydrated, but something told me that Hodgepyle wouldn't be open to any such suggestions. He wasn't. By means of furious and repeated bellows, he quelled the incipient riot, then declared that we were crossing the gorge, and right quickly, too.
"'Put him on a stretcher, then,' he said impatiently, in reply to protests from Brown's nephew. "'And as for you—'
He rounded on me, glaring.
"'Did I tell you? No tricks, I said.' "'Kill her,' Brown said hoarsely from the ground. "'Kill her now!' "'Kill her? Not bloody likely, old son.'
Hodgepyle's eyes gleamed with malice.
"'She's no more risk to me alive than dead, and a good bit more profit alive.' But I'll keep her in line.
The knife was never far from his grasp. He had it out in an instant and had seized my hand. Before I could so much as draw breath, I felt the blade press down, cutting part way into the base of my forefinger.
Remember what I told you, do you?
He breathed it. His face was soft with anticipation.
I don't need you whole.
I did remember, and my belly hollowed, my throat dried to silence. My skin burned where he cut, and pain spread in a flash through my nerves. The need to jerk it away from the blade was so strong that the muscles of my arm cramped with it. I could imagine vividly the spurting stump, the shock of broken bone, ripped flesh, the horror of irrevocable loss. But behind Hodgepyle, Tebby had risen to his feet. His odd, smudgy stare was fixed on me, with an expression of fascinated dread. I saw his hand close in a fist, his throat move as he swallowed, and felt the saliva return to my own. If I was to keep his protection, I must keep his belief. I fixed my eyes on Hodgepyle's and made myself lean toward him. My skin quivered and jumped, and the blood roared louder in my ears than the voice of the cataract. But I opened my eyes wide. A witch's eyes, or so some said. Very, very slowly, I lifted my free hand, still wet with Brown's blood. I reached the bloody fingers toward Hodgepyle's face.
"'I remember,'
I said, my voice a hoarse whisper.
"'Do you remember what I said?'
"'He would have done it. "'I saw the decision flash in his eyes. "'But before he could press the knife blade down, "'the bushy-haired young Indian leapt forward, "'grabbing at his arm with a cry of horror. "'Distracted, Hodgepyle let go his grip and I pulled free. "'In an instant, Tebby and two more men surged forward, "'hands on knives and pistol grips. "'Hodgepyle's thin face was pinched with fury.' But the moment of incipient violence had passed. He lowered his own knife, the menace receding. I opened my mouth to say something that might help diffuse the situation further, but was forestalled by a panicked cry from Brown's nephew.
"'Don't let her talk. She'll curse us all.' "'Oh, bleeding hell,' said Hodgepyle, fury transmuted to mere crossness.
I had used several handkerchiefs to bind Brown's splint. Hodgepyle stooped and snatched one from the ground, wadded it into a ball, and stepped forward.
"Open your mouth,"
he said tersely, and seizing my jaw with one hand, he forced open my mouth and crammed the wadded fabric into it. He glared at Tebby, who had made a jerky move forward.
"I shan't kill her, but she says not a word more. Not to him."
He nodded at Brown, then Tebby.
"Not to you, nor me."
He glanced back at me, and to my surprise, I saw a lurking uneasiness in his eyes.
"Not to anyone."
Tebby looked uncertain, but Hodgepile was already tying his own kerchief round my head, effectively gagging me.
"Not a word," Hodgepile repeated, glaring round at the company. "Now, let's go."
We crossed the river. To my surprise, Lionel Brown survived, but it was a lengthy business, and the sun was low by the time we made camp, 2 miles past the gorge on the farther side. Everyone was wet, and a fire was kindled without discussion. The currents of dissension and distrust were still there, but had been damped by the river and exhaustion. Everyone was simply too tired for further strife. They had tied my hands loosely, but left my feet unbound. I made my way to a fallen log near the fire and sank down, utterly drained. I was damp and chilled, my muscles trembling with exhaustion. I'd been forced to walk from the river, and for the first time I began to wonder whether Jamie would, in fact, find me. Ever. Perhaps he had followed the wrong group of bandits. Perhaps he had found and attacked them, and been wounded or killed in the fight. I'd closed my eyes, but opened them again, seeking to avoid the visions this thought had conjured up. I still worried about Masali. Either they had found her in time or they hadn't. But either way, her fate had been decided. The fire was burning well, at least. Cold, wet, and eager for hot food, the men had brought an immense pile of wood. A short, silent black man was stoking the fire, while a couple of the teenagers rifled the packs for food. A pot of water was set on the fire with a chunk of salt beef, and the lion-haired young Indian poured cornmeal into a bowl with a lump of lard. Another bit of lard sizzled on an iron girdle, melting into grease. It smelled wonderful. Saliva flooded my mouth, absorbed at once into the wad of fabric, and despite discomfort, the smell of food bolstered my spirits a little. My stays, loosened by the travel of the last 24 hours, had tightened again as the wet laces dried and shrank. My skin itched beneath the fabric, but the thin ribs of the boning did give me a sense of support, more than welcome at the moment. Mr. Brown's 2 nephews, Aaron and Moses, I had learned, limped slowly into camp, a makeshift stretcher sagging between them. They set it gratefully down beside the fire, evoking a loud yell from the contents. Mr. Brown had survived the river crossing, but it hadn't done him any good. Of course, I had told them he should be kept well hydrated. The thought undid me, tired as I was, and I made a muffled snorting sound behind my gag. One of the young lads nearby heard me and reached tentatively for the knot of my gag, but dropped his hand at once when Hodgepile barked at him.
"Leave her."
"But
doesn't she need to eat, Hodge?"
The boy glanced uneasily at me.
"Not yet, she doesn't."
Hodgepile squatted down in front of me, looking me over.
"Learned your lesson yet, have you?"
I didn't move, just sat and looked at him, infusing my gaze with as much scorn as possible. The cut on my finger burned, my palms had begun to sweat. But I stared. He tried to stare back, but couldn't do it. His eyes kept slipping away. That made him even angrier. A flush burned high on his bony cheeks.
"Stop looking at me."
I blinked slowly once, and kept looking, with what I hoped appeared to be interested dispassion. He was looking rather strained, our Mr. Hodgepile was. Dark circles under the eyes, muscle fibres bracketing his mouth like lines carved in wood, sweat stains wet and hot beneath the armpits. Constant browbeating must take it out of one. All at once he stood up, grabbed me by the arm and yanked me to my feet.
"I'll put you where you can't stare, bitch," he muttered,
and marched me past the fire, shoving me ahead of him. A little way outside the camp, he found a tree to his liking. He untied my hands and rebound my wrists with a loop of line wrapped round my waist and my hands fastened to it. Then he pushed me down into a seated position, fashioned a crude noose with a slipknot, and put it round my neck, tying the free end to the tree.
"So as you won't wander away," he said, pulling the rough hemp snug around my neck. "Shouldn't want you to get lost. Might be eaten by a bear, and then what, eh?"
This had quite restored his humour. He laughed immoderately, and was still chuckling when he left. He turned, though,